We are in week three of a series called Jesus on Every Page. We thought it was going to be a four-week series. Now we're thinking maybe five that would lead us into Mother's Day. But the pastors are looking forward to being a part of it in the coming weeks. But it's all about learning to see Jesus at work in all of our Bibles. I don't play a lot of video games, but every once in a while I get the bug to play a video game. Maybe I'm working too hard or something and I want to play a game. So what I do is I fire on the Xbox and I look through the store, I find a game that I want to play, I buy it, download it, and I play the game from start to finish. And then I'm probably done. And then I'm done playing video games for probably 6 months. Well, this last month I got the bug to play a video game, so I fired it up and I downloaded and played a game called Subnautica. Subnautica, it's this weird game where you fly in, you crash land on this alien planet, right? And so you're the only human life form. There's all kinds of life forms, but nothing is human there. No one else survived, but the thing is, the entire planet, almost the entire planet, is covered in water, right? And so all of the gameplay happens in the water, where you're trying to survive and you're trying to maybe ultimately find a way off the planet to go back to your home planet. And so all of the searching and finding resources and finding food all happens underwater. And at first you're kind of in these like shallow waters and it's pretty safe and it's cute. The fish and the creatures are kind of cute. But as the game progresses, you end up getting an oxygen tank and you end up going really, really deep into the water, past the point where the light that shines from the sun is no longer illuminating what's happening under there and you just have a little flashlight. And it's terrifying. Because the creatures that are down there are absolutely freakish. And I remember when I first started playing, I told my wife, I can't play this game. It's too scary. It just stressed me out. But as I pushed through a little bit, I started to understand the terrain and I started to kind of know where things were and where things were going. And I knew my way around. And before you knew it, I was playing. It was like time to go to bed. But I was telling my wife, just 10 more minutes. I can get, you know, one or two more things. And here's the point, though. What was scary when I started to understand my way around became fascinating, right? So what was terrifying became fascinating. And so when we're talking about our Bibles, right, I think there's a lot of people who enjoy your Bible when it comes to the shallow waters, right, the safe spots. Anybody have like five or six spots? You're going to flip open your Bible. You know where you're going to go. I'm going to go to the Sermon on the Mount. But you might know the place where you're going to go. But then there's other places where you're like, I would never go there because I don't know it, right? It's like the deep sea and you don't understand it. But what we're hoping to do in this series as we talk about our Bibles and understand that Jesus is at work in the entire Bibles is just to whet your appetite for the deeper seas of the Bible, right? The deep things, places that maybe we've never thought we would go. And not just to understand them, but to actually read them correctly. Jesus tells us that all of the Bible, the entire Bible, ultimately points to him. And when we read our Bibles with Jesus colored glasses on, that we're actually learning to read it correctly. I was doing a little bit of research this past week on this sermon, and I came across a study that said the average preacher, modern preacher today, will preach from the Old Testament approximately 10% of the time. But if you remove Psalms and Proverbs, that percentage goes down to 4% of the time. And so that's not a lot of time, especially when you consider that the Old Testament comprises 73% of our Bibles. Right, but we just don't spend a lot of time there. The modern preacher will preach a lot from the writings of Paul because it's real prescriptive, it's real easy to understand. They'll preach a little bit less from the Gospels and from the Old Testament, almost not at all. And in a sense, I almost can't blame them, right? Because we, as at a church like this, we're Christians, right? So we'd be Christian teachers. Christian, Christ-ian, little Christs, right? Everything that we do is ultimately about Jesus Christ. And so even people like me, sometimes I read my Old Testament and I'm just thinking, where is Jesus at work in any of this? You know, so we end up just staying in kind of the more comfortable places. But the truth is this, is that Jesus is everywhere in the Bible if you understand and know how to see him. B.B. Warfield, he's a 19th century theologian. When talking about the Old Testament, he described it like this: a room fully furnished, but dimly lit. Just think about that. Fully furnished, but dimly lit. So in the Old Testament, you have this beautiful room with furniture and artwork and all sorts of things that are really, really beautiful, but it's just so gosh darn dark in there that what would normally be something that's really beautiful, you end up just stubbing your toe on. Right? And he would go on to say that not until you open the window of the New Testament to let the light of Jesus shine into the Old Testament can you appreciate all the beauty that's actually happening there. Right? Until only at that point can you see all these incredible works of art that are pointing to Jesus, but without the New Testament, it's just too dark to even understand them. And so five places, just briefly before we get into it, five places that we see Jesus in the Old Testament. Number one is this. We see Jesus in direct action, revealing God's involvement in the world. We talked about this in the first week, right, where Jesus was involved, directly involved in creation. So it's not like it kind of looked like Jesus or it could be interpreted as Jesus. It was just Jesus doing something. He is very much at work in the Old Testament in direct action. He's also at work. He can be seen in covenant law. Revealing God's commitment to us. We talked about this a little bit last week. And just understand this, that the context of the entire covenant law is covenant. The first thing that God would come and bring the Israelites is not rules, right? It's covenant love. It's a commitment to care for them and to watch out for them. And then the law that they're supposed to follow, that's a follow-up. And it makes sense because covenant law doesn't make any sense without covenant. You think about all the married people in here that have a covenant commitment, right? Doesn't make any sense without relationship. If I was just go up to a strange lady on the street that I didn't know and said, like, do you promise to love, cherish, and respect me till death do us part? Because I do. I'm better or for worse, sicker or poorer, right? Like, till death do us part, I'm there for you. Right? Like, she would just think I'm crazy. Right, because you can't have covenant law outside of covenant relationship. And covenant, by the way, is very close to the heart of Jesus. He would come in centuries later and he would talk to us about the covenant of his blood, the new covenant of his blood. And then number three, we see Jesus in ethics, right? The ethics of the Old Testament revealing God's love for us. It's always been the heart of God to take care of us and to teach us how to care for each other. We see Jesus in the Old Testament in prophecy, right? When they're foretelling, revealing God's plan for us. By the way, I don't want to go too much into that because the pastors are going there hopefully in the coming weeks, so I won't spoil their points. And then lastly, number five, and this is where we're going this morning, we see Jesus in the Old Testament in story, revealing God's character. So I've always been someone who's attracted to story. I'm still learning who I am as a pastor, but I do believe that one of the things God has made me is a storyteller. Story has always been real to me. I've always understood through story. So not only do I speak through story, oftentimes it's story that speaks to me. And so one thing that we're going to do just briefly this morning is this. We're going to look at the Old Testament, but specifically the story of the Old Testament and how that points to Jesus. You just have to understand one thing before we get into it, and it's this. The Bible is not a book. The Bible is 66 books, right? And it's a library of books. 66 books written by, we think, 40 authors over thousands of different years, right? From in different cultures, even written in different languages, and a huge amount of variety. In the Bible, we have books of history and poetry and letters and apocalyptic literature. In fact, you can see that this is kind of the breakdown. There at the beginning of your Bible, right, we have the Law of Moses, the first five books, also called the Torah. Then we have these history books in the Old Testament. And then we have this section in the middle that's poetry, right? Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. Then we get to the major prophets. These are these big books. Right, by these major prophets. Then we have all these minor prophets that's probably the super deep. If you're wondering what the real deep ocean of the Old Testament is, for most of us, it's probably the minor prophets. Right? Then we jump into the New Testament, and then we have the Gospels, right? The four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Then we have a history book, Acts. It can also be considered Luke Part 2 because it was written by Luke and it continues on his story. Then we have Paul's letters, which comprise the majority of the New Testament. He's writing them to churches and sometimes people. Then we have this letter to Jewish Christians called Hebrews. We don't know who wrote that exactly. We have some theories, but that's what they are. Then we have these letters to the entire church, James, Peter, John, Jude. And then lastly, we have the book of Revelation, which is the revelation of John. So here you can see that this is a huge amount. This is not one book, right? It's a library written by different people in different languages spanning thousands of years. But what's amazing is, despite the incredible diversity that you see in the Bible, the entire Bible is all ultimately telling one story. And if you were to ask this question, like, well, what is the story of the Bible? It could ultimately be summed up in Jonah chapter 2 and verse 9. This is what Jonah says from the belly of the whale. He says this: salvation comes from the Lord. Right, in even 700 years before Christ, this is a foretelling of the Lord who would come and offer salvation, which is the story of Jesus. And every book told correctly moves that story forward. And so you can learn a ton from Jesus in the Old Testament through story. I'm sure you probably heard the phrase before: a picture is worth a thousand words. Right, and so I'm going to say, listen to these three words: cute, warm, sweet. Right? Does those do anything to you? Does those elicit any sort of emotion? You might be thinking, I guess, I don't know, cute, warm, and sweet. But now what if I put up this picture of baby Grace, my daughter? Well, that's just different, right? It's cute, and it's warm, and it's sweet. But a picture has a way of soliciting in you an emotion and leaving an impression on you in a way that words alone oftentimes don't. And so for me personally, I can tell you that one of the times the Bible really came alive to me was not when I just started memorizing obscure scriptures here and there, memory verses, but it was when I started to understand the story that the Bible was telling, the picture that the whole Bible was painting, if you understand it as a whole. And so you can learn a ton about Jesus, not just from verses, but from story. And so because this is not a four-semester class, maybe someday, it's just one sermon that I've already, you know, spent half my time. Because it's just that, the best we can do this morning is I've got two quick examples for you when it comes to the Old Testament story and how we see Jesus in those stories. You could sum it up like this, where we're going. The two stories, we see the forgiveness of Jesus in Joseph, this is 1650 BC, and then we see the redemption and generosity of Jesus in Boaz in 1280-ish BC. Okay, so first off, Genesis chapter 37, if you've found it, this is Joseph. Verse 2, this is the account of Jacob's family line. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. Any girls wish they had those names? Bilhah, Zilpah. Now we've got some expectant families in the room. Can you just write those down? Bilhah. It's my daughter, Zilpah. Continuing on, and he brought their father a bad report about them. Okay, so this is a mistake. Next slide. He brought their father a bad report about them. I was always a pretty good narc as a little kid. I had an older sister. Narking on your older sister is, in fact, a pretty good way to procure favors from your mom. Not a great way to get your siblings to like you. Right? And so that's one of the things that Joseph is doing here. He's essentially narking. He's going with bad reports to his father. It's one of his mistakes. Verse 3, now Israel, you guys know Israel by his previous name, which is Jacob, right? This is the father. Jacob loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born to him in his old age and he made an ornate robe for him. This is a huge parenting mistake. All the parents in here know. I don't think we're supposed to have one favorite kid, but if we do have a favorite kid, at least we're quiet about it. At least it's a secret favorite. And you definitely don't make a huge gift for one kid and give nothing to the other 11, right? Huge parenting mistake. What do you think the brothers think about what has transpired. Well, verse 4, when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him, no surprise there, right? And could not speak a kind word to him. And it just keeps getting worse and worse for Joseph. Joseph is not particularly socially aware. So one day he comes down the stairs for breakfast and his 11 brothers are sitting there and he says, guys, you're not going to believe this, but I just had the strangest dream. And they're like, oh yeah, what is it? And he says, so here it is. We were all in the field and we were all collecting wheat and we all had bundles of wheat. And then all of a sudden, my bundle of wheat stands up real tall and all of your bundles of wheat bow to my bundle of wheat. Isn't that weird? And they're thinking, yeah, that's pretty weird. So weird that we might have to kill you. Right? And Joseph says, no, it gets better. Right? He comes back. He says, I had another dream. This time, the sun and the moon and 11 stars all bowed down to me. Keep in mind that he has how many brothers? 11, right? Sun, moon, and 11 stars all bowed down to me. Isn't that crazy? And their thing is so crazy that you might want to lock your door at night, right? But they just say, yeah, that's super cool. And at this point, they conspire to kill their brother Joseph. Right, but then at the last minute, they decide, what's the point in killing him? We don't need to kill him. What we can do then is we can sell him as a slave. And so they do that, right? There's a caravan, there's slavers that are coming through town, and they sell him to these slavers that are ultimately heading for Egypt. Joseph ends up, after all of this, in Potiphar's house, right? Potiphar is one of Pharaoh's top officials, so he's this huge uppity-up guy, and he's working in Potiphar's house, and Joseph is always this real diligent, hard worker. He's faithful. He's got a positive attitude. So everything is going very good for Joseph until there's this little incident with Potiphar's wife. Right, Potiphar's wife tries to seduce Joseph. Joseph rejects her, runs away, and she screams rape. Right, and so then it's this whole thing. He gets thrown into prison. But again, his attitude is so positive, right? He continues to just rise to the top, rise to the top, rise to the top. In fact, and in one point, because of some of these dreams that he's able to interpret, Pharaoh himself makes Joseph, in a very short time, in charge of all of Egypt. Right, so this is a pretty big reversal. Well, right about this time, there's this huge famine that spreads across all of the land. And so nobody has any food except for one place, Egypt. Right, so now everyone's coming to Egypt to ask for food, right, so that their families don't starve. And amongst these people that are coming to beg the king, the head of all of Egypt, are Joseph's brothers. Right, so they're coming, they come and they walk up and they don't realize that this ruler that's standing before them, the ruler over all of Egypt, is their brother that they sold into slavery. They don't realize it. Joseph does. So the brothers, they kneel, they bow before Joseph, and I'm sure Joseph is thinking, those dreams don't sound so far-fetched now, right? It's like it's happening, right? They're bowing. And he's like, wow, that's pretty interesting. And so they're talking, you know, please give us some food for our families that we wouldn't die. And Joseph goes through this whole thing. Again, he knows this is his brothers. And he says, well, maybe you guys are spies. Have you ever thought about that? Maybe you're spies and maybe I kill you. And they're thinking, what? No, we're not. Like, we just came. Not spies. And he says, well, maybe you're spies and maybe I kill you just in case. And no. And so this whole thing, he goes through this whole charade, right? He knows that it's his brothers. Ultimately, he reveals himself in incredible kindness and incredible forgiveness to his brothers. Genesis 45, verse 4, it says this, then Joseph said to his brothers, this is the big reveal, come close to me. When they had done so, he said, I am your brother Joseph, the one who you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves. Hear this forgiveness for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. You shall live in the region of Goshen and be near me, you, your children and grandchildren, your flocks and herds and all you have. And he kissed all his brothers and wept over them. And later he would go and he would tell Pharaoh, who's his boss, right, what has happened. And listen, it goes on, verse 19. You were also directed to tell them this, Pharaoh says, do this. Take some carts from Egypt for your children and your wives and get your father to come, right? Because the father thought that Joseph had been killed. Get your father to, never mind about your belongings, because the best of all Egypt will be yours. And then verse 23, and this is what he sent to his father, 10 donkeys loaded with the best things of Egypt and 10 female donkeys loaded with grain and bread and other provisions for his journey. So here you have, was 1600 years before Jesus was born, one of the clearest pictures that we have in the Old Testament story of the forgiveness and the generosity that's offered to all of us through Jesus on the cross, right? The brothers in the story, we are representative of us, right? They would betray Joseph, and that represents humanity that would come and betray Jesus, right? And then Joseph, when he returns, he's finally in power. He's at a place where he could strike back with vengeance, right, for their betrayal. He doesn't do it, right? Instead, he comes in forgiveness. And in the same way, when Jesus is risen from the dead, he had every right to finally come with the sword, right? I tried to be nice and you murdered me, right? But even after that, he's risen from the dead and he still comes in kindness and forgiveness, and he vows to take care of us as his family. And so here's four parallels from the story of Joseph and the life of Jesus. Joseph is betrayed by his brothers. Jesus is betrayed by his followers. Joseph is sold into slavery and written off as dead, remember? Jesus is tortured and killed and put in a tomb. Joseph is appointed ruler over all of Egypt by Pharaoh, whereas Jesus is appointed Christ the King by God the Father. Joseph forgives his brothers and vows to take care of them. Jesus forgives us and vows to take care of us. So you can see here that what it in a lot of ways might seem kind of like a story that we're not sure how this applies to us, right? And how this looks like Jesus. But now that we have Jesus, it's actually really easy, right? We can go back and we can say, where is the character of Jesus present in these stories? Whereas before, like, it was hard for Joseph, right? That's pretty difficult to act like Jesus because he had never met Jesus, never heard of Jesus. Right, but in our particular case, we can go back and we can just see what looks like Jesus, and we can see that that's a shadow of him in these stories. Okay, number two is Boaz. Of course, Boaz is found in the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth is the closest thing that the Bible has to like a Nicholas Sparks romance novel. I found that my wife has always known the book of Ruth and Esther better than I have. So I'm growing, but here we go. Ruth chapter 1 and verse 1. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, so this is a little family unit, right, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. So this famine, again, a famine hits. And so this husband, along with his wife and his two sons, they decide to move to this place called Moab, the nation of Moab. And they set up shop there and they eat and they live for about 10 years. Both of the sons, the younger sons, they grow up and they marry local girls. One of them's name is Orpah, right? And in fact, Orpah is where Oprah gets her name from. On her birth certificate is actually Orpah, but none of her family knew how to pronounce it correctly or write it correctly, so Oprah came up quickly. But Orpah was one of the daughters and the other, or excuse me, one of the wives, and the other wife was Ruth, right? And so so everything is going great, right? The two sons now have wives. There's six of them. Everything is going super good until one by one, all of the men begin to die. Right, the father dies, one son dies, the other son dies. And now before you know it, the only thing that remains is the three girls. It's just Naomi, who's the mother, and her two daughters-in-law. Right, and that's it. And so Naomi thinks, well, okay, hopefully the famine is over. I'm going to head back to Bethlehem, where I'm from. You guys are locals here. You guys are natives. Just stay here where you're from, your homeland, and find new husbands. Orpah says, yeah, that's fine. I'll take you up on that. Ruth, however, has this really strong connection and loyalty to Naomi. Listen to this, verse 16. She says this to her mother, to her mother-in-law. "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me." This is a seriously good daughter-in-law, right? Anybody here have a mother-in-law? Probably a number of us, right? I love my mother-in-law. I bet you love your mother-in-law too. This is a whole nother level though, right? Where may God punish me if even death separates us, right? So this is pretty intense. So Naomi says, wow, okay, well, that's fine. We'll go. You can come. So they end up heading back. They head back to Bethlehem, and everything's pretty cool there. The problem is this, is that they're super poor, right? They're extremely poor. Luckily for them, what they can do in Bethlehem is they can glean from the fields, right? We just talked about that last week. They can go and essentially eat the charity grain that's reserved for them in other people's fields it's by the street. And so Ruth is there and she's gleaning from a field. In this particular case, it's barley. And the owner of the field, Boaz, he comes along and he sees Ruth and he thinks, whoa, right? This is a major babe. And so he talks to her and he ends up giving her all kinds of elaborate gifts, right? He says, I am happy to have you in my field and you can drink from this water. This water is reserved just for the workers, but you can drink from it. And in fact, you can pick, you don't even have to pick from just the charity grain. You can pick from the non-charity grain too if you want. So just happy to have you here. So Ruth says, thanks, great. She goes back to Naomi, her mother-in-law, tells her what's going on. And Naomi, the mother-in-law, says, wait, did you say Boaz? B-O-A-Z, Boaz? She says, that guy is related to my dead husband who died earlier in this book, right? And she says, in fact, so that would make him our kinsman redeemer. And what that means is this, is he's obligated by law to marry you, and he has to take care of me. So that's awesome, right? He has to take care of us. That's the law. And Ruth says, that's great, right? How do I get him to marry me? And Naomi says, well, if I'll tell you how to get any man, and here it is, break into his house. That's the first step. Break into his house, and while he's sleeping, you go and lay by his feet. And Ruth's thinking, what? No, that sounds like the opposite of a good idea, right? But Naomi, she's pretty insistent on this is the way to get him. So Ruth goes along with it, breaks into the house while Boaz is sleeping, lays by his feet. Well, Boaz wakes up in the middle of the night and he loves what's happening here, incredibly. And he wants to marry Ruth. He says, this is great. So incredible wedding plans, and then the drama hits. Right, of the story. Turns out there's another man in town. And this man is also related to Naomi's dead husband and a closer relative. So actually he has the right to not only Ruth, but also to the land. So this is a disaster, right? So Boaz says, and also keep in mind here that Ruth is a Moabite. So this is like, there is deep-seated racism happening at this point. And to marry a Moabite would be deeply shameful, right? But Boaz says, I don't care. This is my love. I want to marry this woman. He says, I'm going to go talk to this other person, and we'll see if we can get it sorted out. And so he goes to this person, and turns out this other guy, essentially what he wants is he just wants the land, right? He doesn't even know. And Boaz says, well, turns out, you know, and you can also marry this Moabite woman named Ruth. And the other guy says, whoa, you know, I'm not exactly looking for that. I'm not looking to settle down right now, especially with a Moabite woman. So maybe you should take care of all that stuff. And Boaz says, well, I'd be happy to. And so all of this great stuff happens, right? Boaz and Ruth are married. And incredibly, the icing on the cake here is that they would come and they would have a son. Boaz and Ruth would have a son named Obed. And Obed is King David's grandfather. And so one of the reasons that the book of Ruth is really important is that it shows that this Moabite, broken, imperfect woman who's gleaning from the field is actually one of the mothers, if you would think about it like this, of Jesus, right? And that she's actually named in the genealogy of Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew. So here you can kind of see 1,200 years before Jesus is born, you can see this breathtakingly beautiful picture of Christ's redemption and generosity through the character of Boaz, right? And so here's three parallels that you have from Boaz in the book of Ruth and Jesus. Boaz generously offers food and water to Ruth. Jesus generously offers the bread of life and the living water to all people. Boaz pursues empty-handed Ruth. You know what I'm saying by that? She has nothing. She's poor, right? He pursues empty-handed Ruth as his bride. Jesus pursues empty-handed humanity as his. Boaz laid down his reputation for Ruth, right, by marrying a Moabite woman. Jesus humbled himself by becoming human and suffering the humiliation of the cross. And so I hope you can see that's one of the ways that we encounter Jesus in the New Testament is that there's all of these figures in the story. And whereas before, without the New Testament, that would be impossible. There would be no way to do that. But because we've thrown open the window of the New Testament and let the light shine into the Old Testament story. Now, what otherwise can be like really deep waters and we don't know what that has to do with anything, we can see that those are some of the clearest pictures of the character of God. And here's my takeaway for the morning. It's this: Jesus is still making appearances. Just as he did in the Old Testament, Jesus is still making appearances today through his body, the church. Right? So when we see the story of Joseph, we can see, wow, this is a picture of who Jesus is in the person of Joseph, right? And then when we see the story of Boaz, we see, oh, this is a picture of Jesus in the man Boaz. And so if you were to be able to zoom out over all history, right, and you can see the beginning from the end, and you could see Jesus at work throughout all of history. You could see, oh, he's at work in creation here, and he's working Joseph, he's at work in Boaz, he's in work in King David, he's working Melchizedek, he's at work in Nehemiah. And then you were able to go to 2018 and ask this question: where is Jesus at work in 2018? The answer would be in this thing known as the church. Right? You and me. And you might be thinking, I've met the church. That's a stretch. Right? I agree with you. Right? Like, we do this incredibly imperfectly. Right? All of us. But this is the incredible calling of the church, is that we would be an appearance of Jesus in the world today. Just like Boaz was, just like Joseph is, so are you called to be an appearance of Jesus. And again, we always do that imperfectly, and you might be thinking, well, how do we do it? Well, again, for Joseph and for Boaz, it was pretty tough, right? They weren't able to just see what Jesus looked like, right? So it was a lot harder for them to take on the Spirit of Christ. But for us, it's a lot easier because we just have the example of Jesus Christ and we have the Holy Spirit, right? So all we have to do is we just have to see how Jesus lived, and then we live like him. Right, through forgiveness, through generosity, through service. In fact, it can all be summed up in one phrase, and the phrase is this: self-sacrificial love. That's the whole idea, right? Sacrificing yourself for the sake of love. It's a really bad way of reading scripture to think, wow, I'm sure glad Jesus did all that tough stuff, that way I don't have to. Right, that is not a biblically literate way of understanding the Bible. The way that we understand our Bibles is this, is that Jesus showed us the way of love, and we are called to mirror what he does. In fact, look at what he says in John chapter 13, verse 15. He's just finished washing the disciples' feet, and he says this: I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. Right? That's pretty clear, right? I've done stuff, and that's the example, and now you do what I did, right? And so if you're thinking, I'm not sure if it works in 2018, it's a different world. Well, it doesn't matter, right? Our calling is very simple. which is this, simply to imitate Christ in everything that we do. Listen to what John would say in 1 John chapter 3, verse 16. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. Right? He laid down his life for us, and what do we do about that? We also lay down our lives for other people. And so as we close this morning, here's the question that I have for you. If someone were to look at my life, would they be able to see Jesus at work in the world? Ask yourself that question. If someone were to look at my life, right, like instead of us doing a study on the life of Boaz, and spoiler, these are deeply imperfect people, right? Like it's not like these people nailed it all the time, but we were able to look at their life and see Jesus at work in the world. And is that true for you? Right? If someone were to look at your life, we were to do a study on the life of Hannah, we were to do a study on the life of Carlin, right? We were to do a study on the life of Larry, we'd be able to say that was where Christ was at work in 2018. Is Christ at work in the way that you treat your spouse? Right? Is Christ at work in the way that you treat your kids? Is Christ at work in the way that you treat people who have different political views than you? Right? Is Christ at work in the way that you treat people who have wounded you personally? Right? Because keep in mind, that's the idea of Jesus. It wasn't that he was really nice to his friends who always treated him right. No, he came back in forgiveness to the people that would personally betray him. And that's really where we get the clearest picture of Jesus. It's not how we ultimately treat the people that treat us well, right? It's in how we treat those people who maybe would personally wound us. And that's the calling of Christ. And what's amazing is that when that happens, right, people see, it sounds amazing, but when you act like Christ, people see an appearance of Jesus. Right, they see Christ at work in the world. And so the question that I have for you this morning, simple idea, is self-sacrificial love at work in me? Is self-sacrificial love at work in me?